Morning.
Our Father, as we enter into this time of study, it's our desire that your words would be clear and that we would see you and know you better from this time that we're going to be together. So guide us, protect us in that. We ask this in Jesus' name. Amen. We're going to look at the book of Nahum for a few weeks here. And so I'd like you to turn to Nahum chapter 1, and I'd like to read the 15 verses in chapter 1 to you, if you'll follow along. If you read it, I suppose you sort of found it a little boring, but listen to it as I read. The Burden of Nineveh, the Book of the Vision of Nahum the Elkoshite. God is jealous, and the Lord revengeth. The Lord revengeth and is furious. The Lord will take vengeance on his adversaries, and he reserveth wrath for his enemies. The Lord is slow to anger and great in power, and will not at all acquit the wicked. The Lord hath his way in the whirlwind and in the storm, and the clouds are the dust of his feet. He rebuketh the sea, and maketh it dry, and drieth up all the rivers. Bashan languisheth, and Carmel, and the flower of Lebanon languisheth. The mountains quake at him, and the hills melt, and the earth is burned at his presence. Yea, the world, and all that dwell therein. Who can stand before his indignation? And who can abide in the fierceness of his anger? His fury is poured out like fire, and the rocks are thrown down by him. The Lord is good, a stronghold in the day of trouble, and he knoweth them that trust in him. But with an overrunning flood he will make an utter end of the place thereof, and darkness shall pursue his enemies. What do ye imagine against the Lord? Will he make an utter end? Affliction shall not arise up the second time. For while they be folded together as thorns, and while they are drunken as drunkards, they shall be devoured as stubble fully dry. Here is one come out of thee, or there is one come out of thee that imagineth evil against the Lord, a wicked counselor. Thus saith the Lord, though they be quiet, and likewise many, yet these shall they be cut, thus shall they be cut down when he shall pass through. Though I have afflicted thee, I will afflict thee no more. For now will I break his yoke from off thee, and will burst thy bonds in sunder. And the Lord hath given a commandment concerning thee, that no more of thy name be sown out of the house of thy gods. Will I cut off all the graven image and the molten image? I will make thy grave, for thou art vile. Behold, upon the mountains, the feet of him that bringeth good tidings, that publisheth peace. O Judah, keep thy solemn feast, perform thy vows, for the wicked shall no more pass through thee, and he is utterly cut off. Concerning the first verse there, as we begin this study of Nahum, we need to review a little bit of history. This book is a prophecy against the Assyrian Empire, which is designated as its capital city, Nineveh, in the book. Nahum prophesies the destruction of the city, which occurred in 612 BC. Nineveh was an ancient, famous city. It was founded by the first world dictator, Nimrod, in Genesis 10:11. From Nineveh's walls, temples, palaces, inscriptions, and reliefs, mute yet elaborate witness is given to a city that flourished up to its destruction. Accordingly, the magnificent buildings, artistic designs, and water supply projects of Nineveh have resulted in its being likened to ancient Versailles. That's from Major Cities of the Biblical World. 100 years earlier, Jonah had prophesied that their city was going to be destroyed. They had repented, but a new generation had arisen and had gone back to the barbarism of the past. This is another example of God's mercy and his withholding judgment to a latter time on the disobedient nation. We know practically nothing about Nahum. His name is a shortened form of Nehemiah. He's called the Elkoshite. However, we have no idea where Elkosh was located. It's believed that it was located in Galilee, and the reason for that is the city of Capernaum is located there, and that was named after Nahum. The Hebrew name is Kepher Nahum, meaning the city of Nahum. We are not told the date of the writing, but we can deduce an approximate date from the information in the book. In chapter 3, it mentions the fall of Ammon-No, which is the city of Thebes in Egypt. And the Assyrians conquered that in 663 B.C. So he wrote sometime within that 50-year period between 612 when it was destroyed and when Ammon-No was conquered. It calls it the burden of Nineveh. In prophecy, a burden is a heavy message of weighty importance. It's heavy in the sense that it produces sorrow or grief on the part of the bearer of the message and also the hearers of that message. It's a book of the vision. Hebrews 1:1 says, God at sundry times and diverse manners spake in times past unto the fathers by the prophets. One of the diverse manners was a vision. The prophet is given the ability to see what will happen just as if he was present at the future event. Nahum will prove this in his powerful and vivid descriptions of Nineveh's fall and the events leading up to it in the next chapters. Now let's look at Nahum verses 2-8. And in this, we're going to see the judgments of a merciful God. Pay attention and see what you can find out about Jehovah in these verses. It says in verse 2, God is jealous. We normally think of jealousy as something that's bad, but that cannot be true because our God is holy. God's jealousy is love in action. He refuses to share the human heart with any rival. After all, man was created after his own image. Not because he's selfish and wants us all for himself, but because he knows that upon that loyalty to him depends our very moral life. That's why he gave the Israelites the commandments and the different laws that they were supposed to follow. One of them was so that they would not be infected with the same diseases that were rampant among the Egyptians when they left the country. God is jealous, is not jealous of us. He is jealous for us. He wants our best all the time. And he has provided the information that we need in order to have that. It says, the Lord revengeth, The Lord revengeth and is furious. The Lord will take vengeance on his adversaries. Tied to God's jealousy for his chosen is the vengeance against those who persecute his own and those who snub his mercy. Assyria had often invaded Israel and eventually dispersed the 10 northern tribes. They had laughed in the face of God, as the Rabshakeh did in Hezekiah's day. Man needs to understand that he cannot fight against God and hope to prevail. Everyone who sets themselves against God will end up receiving his vengeance. Assyria had also laughed at God's mercy to them. When they had repented, God granted them mercy in not destroying the city. But they had taken that to mean now, well, he was nothing to begin with. He reserveth his wrath for his enemies. All those who love and serve Jehovah need not fear the vengeance of God. His vengeance is reserved for his enemies alone. In verse 3, a great thing to know, the Lord is slow to anger. Paul uses a similar statement concerning him in the New Testament, because his desire is that all men should come to the knowledge of salvation. God is far more patient than man, though there's a time and place where he does display his anger. It does come quickly and capriciously. God's sword of justice is in its scabbard, not rusted in it. It can be easily withdrawn, but held there by the hand that presses it back into the sheath, crying, "Sleep, O sword, sleep, for I will have mercy upon sinners and will forgive their transgressions." That's a quote from C.H. Spurgeon. "And in great power, and will not at all acquit the wicked." When someone knows the great power of God, it will either lead to trust in him to save and protect, or it will lead to fear of his judgment. And he will not acquit the wicked. God is not like an unjust judge who simply lets the guilty go out of a false sense of compassion. We can't just figure that God will say, "Let bygones be bygones." When we get to heaven, sin must be accounted for, because he will not acquit the wicked. Every sin will be paid for, either in hell or at the cross. But God will not acquit the wicked. Never once has he pardoned an unpunished sin. Not in all the years of the Most High, not in all the days of his right hand, has he once blotted out sin without punishment. That's why we can rejoice as we sang this morning. He's the one that took our place, took our punishment, so that we could live with him. "The Lord hath his way in the whirlwind and in the storm, and the clouds are the dust of his feet." God's in control of even the frightful things of life. Remember Jesus calming the storm? This allows us to rest in peace. In verse 4, "He rebuketh the sea and maketh it dry." This is a reference back to the Red Sea during the Exodus, when it was made dry for the Israelites to walk across, "and drieth up all the rivers." This refers to the Jordan during the Exodus. but also to the rivers of Israel during the summer months that become completely dry or just merely little streams flowing in the banks, within the banks. Bashan languisheth and Carmel and the flower of Lebanon languisheth. Bashan was a place of lush pastures located on the east side of the Jordan. It was originally ruled by Og during the Exodus time. It was taken over by 2.5 tribes that stayed on the eastern side of the river. Carmel is located in the northwest from Jerusalem, and it was a place of vineyards and gardens, very lush in growing things. And Lebanon was known as a place with many flowers in it, as well as the tall cedar trees that were there. The mountains quake at him, and the hills melt, and the earth is burned at his presence. Yea, the world and all that dwell therein. Earthquakes and volcanic activity are personified to represent the terror felt in the hearts of men that do not know God. In verse 6, who can stand before his indignation, and who can abide in the fierceness of his anger? The answer is, who can? Nobody can. Job 4:18 through 21 says this, behold, he put no trust in his servants, and his angels he charged with folly. How much less in them that dwell in houses of clay, whose foundation is in the dust, which are crushed before the moth. They are destroyed from morning to evening. They perish forever without any regarding it. Doth not their excellency, which is in them, go away? They die, even without wisdom. His fury is poured out like fire, and the rocks are thrown down. Again, the image of volcanic eruption with the molten lava flaming as it rolls down the side of the hill, and the rocks that are pitched out of it at an eruption coming down the mountainside. Verse 7, the Lord is good, a stronghold in the day of trouble, and he knoweth them that trust him. This was a message to Judah. And so, interspersed in this description of God's judgment and his ability to destroy things, as terrible as the Lord is to those who deserve his judgment, he is good and does good to the ones who trust in him. For them, he provides a safe place when he sends trouble to those who do not trust him. In verse 8, but with an overrunning flood, he will make an utter end of the place thereof. While it's not named here in the verse, this has direct reference to the fall of Nineveh. The Assyrians had dammed up the nearby rivers and dug canals to the city. One of their rivers actually flowed directly through that city. When a great flood of armies of the Babylonians, Persians, and Scythians gathered together to surround the city and hold it captive, there were great floods of water that came down these rivers and canals, and it weakened the defenses of the Assyrians so that the armies were able to march into the city and utterly destroy it. The darkness shall pursue his enemies. This is better translated, and shall pursue his enemies into darkness. In judgment, darkness is equated to death, the grave, and the lake of fire. And in all of which darkness reigns supreme. God promises to chase the Ninevites until they drop dead. And this is exactly what those armies did. When they tried to escape from the city, they chased them and kept after them until they were able to kill them. In verse 9, what do you imagine against the Lord? The kings of Nineveh had often insulted the Lord in word and in deed. They had just recently took the northern kingdom in 1716 B.C. and dispersed it among other nations. The Lord taunts them here, asking, what else do you think that makes you better than I am? He will make an utter end. Affliction shall not rise up the second time. Jehovah promises them that he will make an utter end. This destruction will be so complete that he will not need to come back a second time to finish the job. That's exactly what happened. It wasn't until in the 1860s that they even discovered the place exactly where the Nineveh was and started to excavate it and find the things that were located there and put on display. You can see some of them in the Metropolitan Museum of Art, and I imagine a lot more over at the British Museum. In verse 10, for while they be folded together as thorns, the leaders believed that they were unbeatable. Here they're compared to a thick bunch of thorn bushes all tangled together that nothing can get through. This reminds me of my back area where I have all these Floridella rosa there trying to get through the, you can't go through them. I mean, they'll just rip you apart before you can get through that bramble of them. And so that's what he's talking about here. And while they are drunken as drunkards, they were so confident that they felt they could sit around, drink until they got drunk. Same thing occurred the night that Babylon was destroyed. They were sitting there thinking that they were safe. And yet the Persians had a plan and they marched right into the city and it destroyed them. In there's one more thing there. And they shall be devoured as stubble, fully dry. After the fields had been cut and were getting ready for the next planting, they would burn off the fields. All the remaining stubble that was left in the fields, they would set fire to it and burn it off before they would plow up for the next planting. And that's what he describes as going to happen to these people. There is one come out of thee that imagineth evil against the Lord, a wicked counselor. This particular statement is about Sennacherib and the counsel he gave to Jerusalem back in 701 B.C. when he had come and was going to destroy Jerusalem. He counseled them to believe in him and not Jehovah, and he would provide for them. In Isaiah 36, at verse 15, Rabshakeh delivers Sennacherib's message. He says, neither let Hezekiah make you trust in the Lord, saying, the Lord will surely deliver us. This city shall not be delivered into the hand of the king of Assyria. Hearken not to Hezekiah, for thus saith the king of Assyria, make an agreement with me by a present, and come out to me, and eat ye every one of his vine, and every one of his fig tree, and drink ye every one the waters of his own cistern, until I come and take you away to a land like your own land, a land of corn and wine, a land of bread and vineyards. Sennacherib was acting exactly like Satan. In Matthew 4:8, again the devil taketh him up to an exceeding high mountain and showeth him all the kingdoms of the world and the glory of them, and saith unto him, all these things will I give thee, if thou wilt fall down and worship me. He wanted to take Jerusalem without so much as firing a shot. He wanted to scare them into believing that God could not take care of them. And that's exactly what we need to worry about ourselves during our life. We must not succumb to the temptations of the devil, that we will gain such and such a thing and so on without the pleasure of God being in it. It says, thus saith the Lord, in verse 12, though they be quiet, and likewise many, yet thus shall they be cut down when he shall pass through. Though I have afflicted thee, I will afflict thee no more. This is a promise to God's people that their strong and many enemies would be cut down when he came to execute just judgment. And Israel, through God, was allowed Syria to afflict them as a purging agent. He would not let Assyria afflict them anymore. For now I will break his yoke from off thee, and will burst thy bonds in sunder. He promises to break off the yoke placed upon them by the Assyria, and to set them free. And the Lord hath given a commandment concerning thee, that no more of thy name be sown out of the house of thy gods. Will I cut off the graven image and the molten image, I will make thy grave, for thou art vile. It was Jehovah's commandment here in this message that there would be no more Assyrians. Any children that would be born from the remaining people that happened to escape would be associated with another country and not with Assyria. The Assyrians' gods would be cut off, and anyone of high standing would be killed for their vileness. While we do know some of the names of the Assyrian gods, they're not ones that were picked up by other countries and did not travel far from where they were put to death in that city. The great message here, Paul uses it in Romans. He says, behold upon the mountains the feet of him that bringeth good tidings, that publisheth peace. O Judah, keep thy solemn feast, perform thy vows, for the wicked shall no more pass through thee. He is utterly cut off. The message of good tidings and peace come because Assyria is cut off. We have good tidings and peace to share because sin has been canceled by the Lord's death. And how beautiful are the feet of those that deliver that particular message, as Paul says. But that's not all he left with them. He said, these are the good tidings here. Now what should you do? Look at the remaining part of that verse. You got good tidings. Do what?
You're supposed to tell people.
Oh, spread them? Yeah, you would spread them? He says to do something here. Just look at what he says to do. Oh, Judah, what?
Keep your feast.
Keep your solemn feast.
Perform your vows.
Perform your vows. And a reason. And when you put that all together, that's a form of, we talked about it back when we were priests.
Worship.
Worship Jehovah. You don't need to worry about this. He's taking care of it. Now, worship him. because God is looking for those who will worship him.